Podcast 109, North Facing Slope. Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest.
All right, so we're eating steak in Monroe, Washington. And I know, it was really good steak. Well, you know, there's other stuff too. Boy, we got a table full of people. And so what's your name? Say your name.
Aya.
There. Write that down so you don't forget. And so unfortunately we started late because I wanted to make lots of chewing noises, but now I've already finished my food. Damn.
Travesty.
So I'm here with Josh, and so Josh, what would you like to know? Do you want to say more about? So I'm trying not to say your last name unless you want to offer your last name.
No, I'm good staying relatively anonymous. So
that's right, because of all the illegal stuff we saw outside, boy.
Right.
You don't want the cops coming.
Yep.
The Monroe police pulling up. You know.
I have bad luck with police anyway, so that's a full subject.
Okay.
I never speed, and yesterday I sped and got a speeding ticket.
We were talking about Jocelyn got a speeding ticket out there, too. On the same road. The Ben Howard Road.
I know it got a warning. I don't think I got a ticket.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Forrest was with me when I got the warning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in case you thought Forrest never speaks, there you heard it. Forrest is here. We thought it would be funny to make podcasts all the time and pretend like Forrest is there and say, Forrest agrees with me. Who would know? All right, so then we came out here. We got here after dusk, so it's pretty much dark, but you have some big, big lights out there, and 5 acres, is that right?
5 acres, yes, on a north-facing slope.
Yeah. So my first bit of advice to you was?
Move.
That's right. Write that down so you don't forget that part. Yeah, I think south-facing slope, better. Better. And what did I say about your greenhouse?
That it's in the wrong spot. Well, that it's, I mean, it just won't succeed on a north-facing slope.
So it's a greenhouse in the shade, and which is like, I think 90% of all the greenhouses I see are in the shade, which seems to be counter to what the greenhouse package, you know, which what it advertises on the package. Damn it.
Yeah, I've never seen a greenhouse advertisement where the greenhouse is in the shade. It's only sunny greenhouses.
You would think putting it there would bring the sun in.
If that were the case, then I think a lot of people in Washington would be welcoming of that, but it's not the case. So I put it in the sunniest place on our property, and with the realization that the biggest challenge isn't necessarily that it's going to be in the shade, but that during the winter we just don't get sun. So we've had 4 days of sun consecutive this time, and in the 6 years that I've been here, it's probably the longest streak by 2 days.
Well, now, I think an important point is that where you are, here in Monroe, this is east of the Seattle area, and you're getting up into the foothills of the Cascade Mountains, and so the rainfall here is double that of Seattle.
It is.
And so with that rainfall being double, that I think that's probably double the cloud cover, double the... So you're in an area that's already got crazy levels of clouds, and to make it more interesting, to make it more of a challenge, north-facing slope.
That's it, shady.
And then there's the trees. They provide some shade and stuff. But it looks like you've had a bit of a treeectomy lately.
I have. I cleared about an acre, three-quarters of an acre of alders that I plan on doing some more intensive growing, planting some fruit trees and some berry bushes, and maybe eventually fence it all in and enclose some a small number of animals, two or three of something small, to help clear out rotten fruit.
So I was looking at where the greenhouse was, and we walked down to the spot that you'd cleared, and I was thinking, like, okay, that spot, the spot that we walked to would be a better spot for a greenhouse, more likely to have, oh, no, they could make all this. You guys want to sing a song?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? What song is your favorite song?
Lullaby, little lullaby, little daddy, lullaby, little daddy.
Okay, you guys know the words, so sing along.
Lullaby, lullaby, little daddy drinking soda. Lullaby, lullaby.
I get the feeling he wrote this song.
I think that you might be correct. I think that he did.
Yeah. So then I think I saw a spot where the greenhouse might do better, and you were thinking the same thing. And we went out there, and the idea was, is like, okay, we've got to do a quick little survey out there to look around, get a look at everything, and then we'll go back inside, and we'll talk about what we saw and make a podcast. So what I didn't say while we were out there was, is that if you were to build some berms there, because like you've got this challenge that you're on a north-facing slope, but right about there, you kind of get this idea of like, you know, maybe just possibly you'll get enough sun coming over, because it's like there's not nearby trees. All the trees are far, far away.
Right.
So it's further up the mountainside there on the south. And I kind of thought, you know, if you built a big old herky berm right about there, I'll bet that would get more sun on the top of the berm. And you mentioned something about, like I remember you saying uttering the words, my traco, like possessive. The traco belongs to you.
Traco, it is a backhoe. And, yeah, it's a JCB 1550B, which is a 16,000-pound backhoe. It happens to be old and in need of some repairs, but it works fine. And it's a beast when it has traction. Two-wheel drive, so I had to craft some chains before I could go anywhere in my mud slick in the spring. The first thing I learned how to do on that was use the backhoe to pull myself backwards when I got stuck. I could definitely pile a berm pretty high. Depends on the size of the requirement. I did some observation about a month ago, and I would definitely have to do some trials to see how tall I would need it. And I think it would be at least a 1 year process to see if I got it the right height.
Well, okay, so a couple things with the berm. One is that I think that you would want the berm to go uphill, downhill, so that as cold air comes, it doesn't pool up. The cold air keeps moving right on by. The other thing is that where we were standing, we were getting kind of close to a dirt road. It's your access road kind of a thing, and other cars drive on it. And I kind of think that, you know, when I'm on a piece of property that joins a road, I really like the idea of not getting the dust and not hearing the cars, like minimizing that where I can. And a big old berm right there would be just the ticket. So I think it would be stacking a couple of functions there.
I see. So you're talking, there's my driveway, and then there's the road, you know, in front of my property. You're talking parallel to the road to my property, perpendicular to my driveway?
Yes.
So that pull there just right. Yeah, okay. And actually, I do have an area where I kind of push some stuff there that actually has tons of logs buried in it that I can still stack up and see. And that's actually one of the areas that would get a lot more sun, too. And it would also get the sun as the sun was coming from the east to the west. That would then be an east-facing wall.
Right. So, I think that there's a lot of advantages there. But, you know, on top of that, I mean, by looking around at yourself, you had some raised beds. You also had a bed that you had flush, and you had rototilled it, and you said that was your best bed this year. But, and I'm thinking that, you know, hugel culture is going to win out and do way better than that in time. And I like the idea of adding texture to the land. And so you had a lot of projects where it seems like flat was the name of the game. And I, like, we went and we visited your orchard. Mm-hmm. I thought in your orchard your trees were planted far too close together, unless those are all like mega dwarf.
They're all dwarf trees. They're all full dwarf, not semi dwarf. So I planted that with the goal of getting fruit fast. and then as time goes on, building up the rest of it with some full-size fruit trees. So I've got some orders in, and I actually got some Antonovka apple rootstock, which is a full-size apple rootstock that that I will be planting out, and I will eventually graft some better varieties of apples too. And then I'm going to be ordering some Antonovka rootstock seed so that I can grow my own. And I've got some other stuff coming from seed too. So my goal there was to get something fast and dense that would supply my raw food diet.
Okay. So and we can talk about that later if you wanted to, the whole raw food thing. But a couple of things is that, in permaculture, and I'm guessing you probably planted those fruit trees a while back.
Just smart.
So in permaculture, we don't like orchards because they're kind of a monocrop thing. And so we like food forests. I think what I would do is I would have a lot of lumpiness, like a lot of hugelkultur beds. And then I would plant a lot of, I'd just go out and go to the store, pick up my favorite apples, and then plant those seeds out in the soil at the beginning of the winter because they need freeze. And the thing is, those apple trees that would grow from that would have an awesome tap root, and you're just going to be prepared for the idea that, you know, a certain percentage of them, like about 20% of them, are going to be spitters. 20% of them are going to be awesome apples, but they're going to be, you know, not true to anything that you ate. And the rest are going to be mediocre. They're going to be like maybe good for applesauce, maybe good for, you know, this, that, the other thing, but not like a great all-purpose apple. So it's kind of like and then for the ones that are the spitters, you could either feed those to critters or you could graft those. You know?
Yeah, so that was actually my goal with the Antonovka, was that I had some assurance that it was an edible apple.
Yeah.
And that it would be full size. Yeah. So
yeah, and a lot of people in Russia, they prefer the apple juice from that variety more than any other. I mean, like that's like you go and you buy apple juice, that's like, oh, there's the crappy apple juice, and then there's the Anatokova or whatever it is. I mean, there's like six different names that all mean the same thing, and I can't remember which one's the most preferred. But you plant those seeds, and they actually grow quite true to see, which is unusual for an apple.
Yeah.
So that would be one variation.
I know, but it's probably going to go a lot longer.
You add commentary as we go. Is that okay? Do you have what's that on your plate?
It is dessert.
Dessert.
What is dessert? Can you tell them?
It is chocolate brown poop.
Chocolate brown poop. You know, your idea of dessert is different than mine. I'm more of a pie guy. But, you know, whatever cooks your chicken there, dude. I'm just surprised your mom would serve you poop for dessert. Hey, and I thought I was going to teach your kids new words. It seems like they're all set.
I was actually waiting for that to come out in his songs. That's generally what he sings about.
He sings about poop.
He does.
Are you a poopophile?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, he said yes. He's... And, okay, well, this is a weird kid.
Come on, I think...
No.
Yeah, don't put it in your mouth like that.
You have to take it off of the kebab now.
See, they got fruit kebabs, and I think there's little bits of cake on there.
Oh, yeah.
And there's chocolate goo on it. Which
metal skewer.
I'm pretty sure that,
the wrong way.
I'm pretty sure that's chocolate. Not actual poop.
Yeah.
So
you'd be right.
Okay. All right. That makes more sense for his mom to be serving up chocolate. sorry, I'm on the tail end of a cold.
All right.
All right. So let's see, what else did we look at? I saw a group of trees out there, and you were telling me, like, maybe some of them are on your property, maybe some of them are on your neighbor's property, but they're on the north side, and I was kind of thinking, like, well, there's a big bunch of conifers, and I was thinking, surely there's something I could build out of that wood. And I was kind of thinking, I want the sun to come through there. And you were saying it's not that big of a problem having those trees right there.
So the reason why it's generally not that big of a problem, especially in the winter, is because the sun doesn't come high enough to be blocked by those particular trees.
And right, the sun's already blocked.
Yes, it's blocked by other trees way higher up on the mountain, essentially at the top of the mountain. I'm about maybe three-quarters of the way up the hill. In the summertime, yeah, I could definitely cast some shade over the greenhouse. In my opinion, at that particular point, it has the cooling effect so that the greenhouse doesn't get to be 140 and cook everything, which is, there was surprisingly a couple of times this summer where it did get warm in the greenhouse.
Okay, so I'm not a big fan of greenhouses. I think I've probably made that clear in several podcasts. I mean, and one of the things I don't think I've mentioned before is that the light that comes through the greenhousey stuff, no matter whether it's glass or plastic or whatever, I mean, that light is not pure sunlight. And so I kind of wonder about the quality of the stuff growing underneath it. Like, you know, if you're not getting the 100% spectrum, if you're only getting, like, 89% of the spectrum, like, then it's like, what's the quality like? Or if there's certain kinds of light that we can't necessarily see that are getting entirely blocked that maybe the plant really needs. And things, that's something I haven't mentioned in a podcast before. But, Sepp Holzer doesn't use greenhouses. And I think it's, and of course, the stuff he's doing is really spectacular and amazing.
Please, careful.
Yes, Sepp Holzer is definitely very impressive. Makes me very depressed to see his property and see my property and say, wow, I have a lot of work to do. So my goal with the greenhouse was to grow tomatoes and watermelons and peppers. Generally here, we do not have enough, to my knowledge, enough heat and sunlight to generate the heat to properly ripen those fruits.
We were the only people who had successful tomatoes last year out of everyone we know that tried to grow. And I would say that, like, it's healthier. I mean, I get your point about the greenhouse, but at the same time, it's like that versus what you get at the store. Like, growing your own, I think, would still be better. It's our only option.
So, all these things are true. And so, like, we talk about permaculture, I think that the long-term mission is how can I be even lazier than I am now?
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have a feeling I just stepped on a tender spot.
Which is not.
Was that a landmine?
I do consider myself to be.
Oh, it stuck to my shoe.
I figured I was pretty lazy, but apparently my wife thinks I work too hard in the garden. So.
Yeah, when a lot of people kind of get bonkers about, I mean, they love gardening so much that it's like they want lots of it. But it's basically with a greenhouse, you are kind of creating a new marriage of things you're going to do. You're saying, if there's ever going to be a sunny day, I will be here, because then I'll open it up so that everything inside doesn't get to like 180 degrees and
sure.
Die. If it gets dry in there, I will water it. I will take on all of Mother Nature's chores, and I will deal with it personally. And with a greenhouse, you get a higher chance of getting funguses, which in this area are a big, big deal. And you've got a higher chance of, like, bug stuff getting out of hand. And
I didn't have any problems with
it. So is this for me right here?
Yes.
Whatever you want.
Oh, I get to be smacky on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. So I did have problems with some fungus, but I had some tomato blight. I don't know the exact problem what it was. Basically, the things turned black and then they died. And that happened to both my outdoor tomatoes and my
blight.
Blight, yeah. And then I did get some, I think it would be blossom end rot on my watermelons. Basically, the blossoms would just fall off and die. And then I did get a little bit of, I think, white powdery mildew on my cucumbers, but they were vigorous enough that it didn't affect them. So the cucumbers did amazing in the greenhouse, and I had tons of them.
So when you would water, did you water the leaves?
I No, I watered very, very rarely. So one of the things that I had in there was I had a like the soaker hoses or the drip hoses that would basically sweat water, and I'd put it around the ground because a few times I did water, and then I realized watered leaves, and I realized that because of the innate humidity in the greenhouse anyways, that was definitely not something that was going to be smart to do anymore. And so I used soaker hoses to water basically at the base of the plants, and I honestly didn't water very much because we had such a short summer this year, and it was very wet anyways, that the ground still, I mean, they didn't need that much water.
So I'm kind of thinking, because normally, when I see blight and I see mildew issues and stuff like that on the leaves of, you know, squashes and whatnot, and melons, then I'm thinking it's because people water the leaves.
Right.
And so one of the reasons people will do there's a certain kind of greenhouse you'll see here in the Pacific Northwest that I don't see anywhere else. And that is where you'll have a greenhouse that's set up and both of the ends are wide open. So there's no way to close the greenhouse.
Right.
So the only function is to keep out water and to keep it drier. But yeah, if you water it and then you close the doors, then yeah, you're increasing the humidity inside enough that it's going to be a problem.
Right.
And so that's a cake.
Yeah.
This is angel food cake.
Yeah, so based on my results this year with the greenhouse, I definitely have a lot more knowledge of what not to do and what to try to get, you know, better results. And as far as like the tomato goes, so I go through like maybe 10 to 15 pounds of cherry tomatoes a week, which would be nice to stop spending that every week and be able to produce my own during the summer, especially with, you know, something that even if it's grown in a poor quality greenhouse is substantially better than a, you know, conventionally produced tomato. And I found actually a company, and I seem to forget their name, is Cool Weather Seeds, I believe. It's a company based in Alaska that has bred some tomatoes that do better in cold weather. They apparently will grow outdoors in Alaska without a greenhouse. So.
Now, Sepulcher, of course, is growing citrus.
Yeah.
And they survive the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine he probably doesn't pull off a lot of lemons in December or anything, but he's getting the plant to survive. So basically, and then, you know, I guess there's two more things to add. One is that, I mean, you can do a variety of sun traps and things like that.
Tiny again.
Oh, it's got a leak in it, Ash. It's got a hole in it.
It's a balloon report.
Yes. I don't know why your balloon has a hole in it.
Balloon suffering.
King. There's toy room.
Yeah, so so you said a key word there, the sun trap, which you would have to have sun in order to trap it.
Absolutely. And you know, those solar greenhouses, they require solar.
they absolutely do.
So I mean, like, if you're gonna suffer in this space, you know.
Right.
Now, okay, so there's this whole thing of like I think it'd be better to like say, okay, tomato plants, I've set you up with the sun trap and everything like that, and you're on your own. Good luck. And basically, when you design it the right way, then what's going to happen is that they're going to hold heat for a long time. I mean, and then there might even be some techniques where you're going to, I don't know, throw some kind of semi-composty material out there, and it's going to add a little more warmth on top of that.
Right.
But so it's like there's that whole area where it's like, and then you walk away, and then it can kind of, I mean, there is the potential that whole system will kind of take care of itself. Now, the other problem is that, like, let's say you do have tomatoes growing in December here, out in the open, like you manage to pull it off. I would say the biggest problem with that isn't going to be, you know, keeping it alive. The biggest problem is you're going to have so much rainfall and so little sunlight that the tomatoes are going to taste lame.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to be just, like, not worth eating.
Right, and my goal would not be to have ripe tomatoes in December. My goal would be at least 4 months out of the year to be able to produce my own tomatoes, for example. So right now I'm producing my own tomatoes for the whole. I'm producing my own. I'm producing my own kale for the whole year, and that's definitely feasible. I was actually surprised that a lot of Napa cabbage grows very well in the winter. So it's doing almost as well as my kale. And so those things I'll be able to produce myself, and in the summer I'll have treats, and I'll just basically have a seasonal diet.
Okay. Yeah, seasonal diet, I think, is an important thing. The next thing is like, okay, let's say you're going to do a greenhouse. You just love, love, love the idea of a greenhouse. I want to suggest Mike Ehler's stuff. And basically the idea is, because you've got a tall greenhouse, so there's all that air in there that could get cold and everything. With Mike Ehler's stuff, I think it's designed more so that you can walk away from it, and it kind of is a little more self-maintaining. Although I still think you're going to have to open it up on the really hot days and stuff, but you're still going to have all the problems that come with a greenhouse. It just seems like his greenhouse design is going to be a better long-term solution. So, I mean, I'm just throwing it out there. I still don't like greenhouses and stuff, but I far prefer something where the plants will take care of themselves rather than plants where you've got to go in and put a lot of work into it. And granted, you're bonkers about gardening. You don't mind putting in the work. All I wanted to say, I don't think that's permaculture.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I agree with you there. Definitely, absolutely not. And I think that, I mean, if we all wanted to be, producing all of our own food in a permaculture way, then we should generally all move closer to the equator. It's much easier, and there's much...
Seth Poulter's doing the permaculture way, and he's nowhere near the equator.
Does he produce, all of his, fuel and all of his... I don't know if he does. From what I understand...
I don't think he produces, automobile fuel.
Sure, but, it's perfectly feasible to produce your methane and oils for fuel.
True, true. What color is that balloon?
Red.
Rock? It's rock colored?
No.
No?
Oh, she says a G instead of a D. Now she's managed to confuse those.
A D.
This will say reg.
Oh, okay.
Rag.
Okay. It's red. Red, yeah, that's what I thought.
And I think of boo.
Boo. Okay. All right. We recorded that.
Yeah.
This is probably an important time to point out to anybody listening to my podcast that does not like the extra commentary and the sound of smacking food, that you've tuned into the wrong podcast, and you seem to have you seem to think this is a professional podcast, and it's not. Go away. So okay. What else do we see out there? What else is going on?
I think that's it. I mean, besides the area that I cleared, I've got a couple of Hugel beds that I just... my goal with that is my neighbor, he runs a landscaping company and has a bunch of clippings. Like, they do a lot of tree clippings and leaves, leaf removal and whatnot. And he has a pile that's of compost that's about as big as this whole area here, which is about maybe 30 by, much bigger than this, maybe about 50 by 60 feet by about 8 feet tall compost that he is just sitting there and has nothing to do with. And he said if I want to get a pickup truck, which I do not have in my possession, and load one up and bring it up here, that I could have all of it that I wanted.
Yeah.
And so my plan is to essentially throw that on top of the Hugel beds, and not a very big layer, and just throw some seeds out there and let them grow. I found that this year my best success was when I threw some composted wood chips and horse manure onto the top of a bed and scattered some seeds and gave a light raking, that it took off very well. And I plan on removing a lot of the labor that I've done that I did this year, and doing that instead.
Okay. All right. Well, I saw your Hugel culture beds or raised beds, and I was thinking admirable start. I was kind of thinking that it'd be great if they were even taller,
right,
and even bigger. But I thought it was still a good place to get going. I also liked how you already had them going, you know, up and down the hill, which is good to let the cold air go past. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Hello. What color is your shirt?
Pink.
Oh, that's what I thought. I wasn't sure.
My shirt.
Your shirt. What color is your shirt?
What color is your shirt, Ash?
I don't know what
I think it's truck colored. It looks like truck.
Truck
color. You bought the shirt.
Me!
You bought the shirt?
Uh-huh.
You chose that over a toy.
A nice shirt featuring trucks.
Yes, that's a secondhand store.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so with the Hugo beds, I had built them and then reread basically the article on Hugo culture and discovered that you had recommended them to be 7 feet tall. And I did, basically I had finished them and then reread the article. And I don't know if you maybe... I know you edited it, but I don't know if you added that information in before the first time you read it or the second time.
I don't know either. I mean, I think there's only like about 40 edits to that article, so I can't remember.
Okay.
But I do remember that when Seth came to the United States a few years ago, then he was talking about like these videos that he has. They're only like 2 or 3 feet tall, and he's like, oh, that's old school. That's before. That's 12 years ago. Now you make them like 6 feet tall.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
What's and your name?
You know, in Japan, that means yes.
What?
Yeah, I know. Weird, huh? It's like, why can't they just say yes?
What?
Or what?
What?
I am Paul, Lord of the Jungle.
Oh, why?
Oh.
Well, why not?
Why?
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 Why not?
Why? Why fuck?
So when I first started, you know, learning about Hugo culture, there was like two videos on YouTube about it, and there was your article about it, and for the most part, there was nothing else. And it actually seems like over the summer, there exploded a number of people actually publishing the information that they were doing about Hugo culture, and I've been finding that, according to your 7 foot tall description, that nobody's doing them 7 foot tall except for somebody in, I think, Costa Rica, South America. I saw somebody build, like, post a picture of, like, 1,200 foot long beds made. And I don't know why that is. I mean, people just like...
Yeah, no, it's still hoo culture when you're at 2 feet, you know. And I mean, wherever you build them, at least, you know, northern temperate areas, that when you do that, then you're going to gain growing season on either end of the growing season. But when you do them 6 feet tall, you gain even more on either end of the growing season, and on top of that, it'll hold more water.
Right.
Although here, I think holding water isn't something that's as much of concern as other places. Although in the summer here, it does, I mean, oddly, even though you get 60 inches of rain a year, so it's like you're closing in on rainforest territory, during the summer, it's still quite dry here.
It is. July and October are generally very dry. And actually, this winter has been dry. I mean, we've only had like 2 inches of rain in December, and we normally get, well, I don't know what I get at my particular property, but the city of Monroe generally gets like 7 inches in December, and we had 5 less than that.
No.
So that's a pretty big drought for Washington State, I think.
Well, now you got to think of this is like not just Western Washington, because just a few days ago, not long ago, I was over in Central Washington, Tenasque, you know, that's some very deserty country.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And
yeah.
So it's like, wow, big change. So, and then not only is this Western Washington, but this is like one of the soggier spots of Western Washington, even soggier than Seattle. Yeah. So, super soggy. So we talked about the hookah beds, we talked about the orchard,
no.
We talked about the greenhouses.
No.
What are we left at? What's left?
I guess I had a plan for a pond. Oh, so one thing that I did not show you is directly behind the house here. It used to be a hillside here, the slope, and so they leveled out the area for the, and hopefully people on the podcast can see my hand gestures. So they leveled out a flat spot on a hill so that they could put, build a home site. And I've got maybe an 8-foot tall dirt wall behind my house that continues up the mountain. And about 9 or 10 months out of the year, water openly seeps out of that. And so I have a year-round water source that I hope to be able to direct, you know, around my property and down to a pond at the very bottom corner of my property. I haven't definitely not thought anything out, and I'm still pretty far away from actually, you know, solidifying any plans for the pond, but it's definitely in my to-do list.
So I think with a pond, there's a couple of tidbits. One is try and get, think multiple ponds. The other is to get the first pond that you build to be as high up as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing is that I think it's really important to think about, will you be able to get all year water dribble?
Yes. So along the side of my driveway, I definitely have all year dribble. As far as how far can I move it around the property is the question.
Okay. If you've got all year dribble, you're in awesome shape, because then what you want to do is you want to try and keep that water above ground, keep it from going under, and then you want to try and direct it to where when you get to any pond, you want to try and dribble it into the pond from as high up as you can to where it hits the surface. That way you get the most oxygen going into the water as possible. I've visited too many places where it's like, look, we built a pond, isn't it awesome? And it looked like a great place for mosquitoes and funk. And it's kind of like, better to let it go to a swamp, because you're going to end up there eventually anyway.
Right.
And don't forget to put up lots and lots of bat houses. You know.
Yes.
But as long as you've got a dribble, you can do trout. I mean, there's all kinds of. I mean, that water can be kept really clean and beautiful and awesome. You can do a natural swimming pool. I mean, there's all kinds of awesome things that can happen from that, as long as you can control the dribble and keep it above ground. So, I would start with trying to get something set up that's as high up on the property as possible, and then you end up at the pond that's down much lower.
Right. Yeah. So actually, the area where you said would be good for the second greenhouse is where I would be thinking, maybe a medium level pond, and then direct the water from that pond go down to the lower pond and a pond. So there's this dirt face behind my house, and then there's basically, it stops, and then the corner, the meets in a corner, and a bunch of water is there all year round too anyways. And so my plan is to essentially dig that area out and have a pond there, because I essentially already have a mosquito breeding ground, and to be able to I'd like to be able to utilize that resource more than just by donating blood to insects.
Damn insects. So I think so I think we covered a lot of different stuff about ponds. We covered, maybe the thing is to flip the table around a little bit. Do you have any questions for me about what you're trying to do, or questions in general, things like that?
No.
I've crushed your dreams enough for one day?
No, honestly, you didn't crush my dreams. I mean, I've heard your podcast where you talk about your fear of crushing people's dreams.
Oh, is it a fear? I didn't know it was a fear.
Or maybe your apprehension, maybe. It could be.
Well, I warned you it was coming.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so, and I said, are you sure you want me to come over? And you were like,
Okay, so here I am.
I knew that coming into it, and basically what I wanted was your input on, you know, the things that I have and, you know, how to make them work better and just to, you know, talk to you and, you know, throw ideas off you and hear your input.
Okay. I think, you know, the slope stuff is, you know, I really think having a place with slope is critically, critically important. Just the south-facing slope thing, you know. And so, but I would rather have north-facing slope than be someplace where it's flat or be like on a valley floor.
Sure.
So that is one improvement.
Yeah, so, I mean, we considered moving in the recent future, or in the recent past, we considered it. And if I were to move somewhere, it would probably not be in the state of Washington simply because of the sun. My goal would be to find a piece of land that would be perfect to growing more variety of fruits besides just the cold wintered ones. And, like, for example, citrus, and have a good crop of citrus rather than just a few lemons off of a small tree. Or I imagine, I don't know what variety stuff is growing, but there are some varieties of citrus that do better in cold weather.
Right,
but,
like the Meyer lemon.
Yeah, but they're not exactly something that you're going to be wanting to eat 20 of in a row. Which
True.
Is something that I do. Or
it does seem like a lot of raw food people head towards the more tropical areas.
Yeah.
So and even some of the Norris and Tulsi are talking about going to Hawaii. And I think they've even already looked at land out there.
Yeah, I mean, Hawaii is a great place, obviously, to grow fruit. So, I mean, if you're a raw foodist and you're into permaculture, I don't think that you'll find an ideal, an ideal scenario for your eating habits in an affordable way in the contiguous 50 states, unless you're, well, maybe parts of California, parts of Florida, but you have other things that make those places not desirable to live in either. But, I mean, some of the tropical fruit trees, like a durian will produce a 50-pound fruit, a jackfruit will produce like an 80-pound fruit, and it's really easy to meet your daily caloric needs by those. And the bananas also are a great thing to grow in tropical areas that you can't really grow well up here.
Right. And so up here, it seems like for a lot of the folks up here, I mean, granted, there's all kinds of options for being a vegan, but the raw thing gets to be a little challenging. Because it comes to food preservation, it's like your options are kind of limited for food preservation.
Right. So for food preservation, what I was researching when I started my orchard, I selected, I've got apples, pears, cherries, peaches, and nectarines growing in there. I've got, I think, 18 trees, and I selected varieties. Well, obviously, some of the varieties will ripen in the summer, and I'll eat them in the summer. But for the apples and the pears, I selected some varieties that will be good for fresh eating, and some varieties that will store for a long time into, you know, this
winter keepers.
Yeah, winter keepers. And then this year, I plan on also growing a lot of squash and pumpkins that will last through the winter also.
Right, right. But then, you know, the idea of canning applesauce, that's out. Because that doesn't meet the raw thing.
Right.
You can dry stuff.
Yep.
But that gets old pretty quick too.
So I was very depressed. So I went to this raw food. It was the International Day of Juice Feasting, and I just made some kale chips, and because I have so much kale growing around here, I was like, what am I going to do with that all? And I met these two ladies that are up from, I think, Bellingham or Arlington, and they sell kale chips for a living. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm just going to, you know, when it gets cold, I'm just going to harvest all my kale and turn them into kale chips, and that way I'll have them. And then they're like, yeah, but they only last for 2 weeks. So it's so sad.
No!
Yeah, that's...
By the way, we had kale chips tonight, and those were awesome. There was, like, goo on them. Normally, everything I've ever had has just been, like, when kale chips, it's, like, just oil and salt, and they were baked. But now these kale chips were not baked. They were put through a dehydrator, right?
Yeah, so depending on the raw food lifestyle that you follow, One of the most consistent things is that as long as it's not, you know, been processed above 115 or 118 degrees, depending on who you talk to, then it would still be considered a raw food. So dehydrators are used a lot for certain things. The kale chips is one of them. So I just made a sauce out of some cashews. What did I put? Cashews, garlic, onion, and some water and salt, and blended them up, and it made a thick paste. And then you just mix that in with the kale, and you put it in your dehydrator, and the result is what you ate.
Wow. Well, normally I'm not a big fan of kale. It seems like I've had the opportunity several times to eat kale directly, and my opinion was that was a bad idea. The technique I used was spit it out. It's damn nasty. And then I've had kale prepared for me dozens and dozens of times, and all those times it was like, spit that out. That's damn nasty. Then I had some kale that was prepared a different way. It's sesame oil and maybe something else. I was like, wow, that's actually, you know, good. And I've had kale several times now that has been good, and I still encounter once in a while the damn nasty. But I got to say, this stuff, so here I am. I normally object wholeheartedly to kale, but this was really good because instead of it being like, here, eat your greens, Popeye, it was more like the stuff that was on the outside was the main flavor thing.
Absolutely.
That complemented the kale. Like, if you just ate the stuff on the outside, it would be boring, but somehow the kale went with it really well, and it had awesome texture.
Well, yeah.
And it was delicious. It was better than eating any potato chips I've ever eaten. I do enjoy a potato chip once in a while.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I built it. First time I tried this particular recipe, and I just kind of pulled it out of my ass. So,
see, now I'm losing my appetite again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think I liked it before that.
I'm speaking figuratively, not literally. Yeah, I will agree with you. The kale, I eat tons of kale, but it is by far my favorite thing, and it is definitely tough to eat a lot of, even a little of. I'll go through and pick some, you know, vegetables from my garden, and I'll eat lettuce and spinach and other things, you know, while I'm in the garden, but I don't generally eat a lot of kale plain in my garden.
Yeah, kale plain, that's like not right. I'm against it.
I've got a YouTube video where my son is going around taking bites off my kale plant and eating them. So I think it's, you just have
the guy with the truck on his shirt.
Yes, the guy with the truck on his shirt. Yeah, you just have to start going.
The guy over here that was eating all of that angel food cake, he's like picking it off. And oh, wait, he was eating poop, wasn't he?
Yes, he was eating poop. Yes.
I was going to say something about pulling things out of your ass.
And then he's eating poop.
No, but yeah, anyway, never mind.
All right. Well, it sounds like we're at a wrap here.
I think so.
Okay. So if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about kale chips, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.